Well, dear friends, I want to welcome you all. We are here to celebrate the life, and celebrate is the word, of a very extraordinary human being whom I love very, very much and whom I will miss very, very much. Our dear friend, Judith Swart Webb, wife of Ship, sister of Kate, mother of Mira, and friend and spiritual sister to everyone in this room. One of the most remarkable people I've ever known. And we're going to have a number of things. We're going to start with a bhajan sung by Beverly. Excuse me. This is the bhajan, the words, "Why are you proud of this body? It is made of clay. All saints and fakirs have written this. The bird of life will fly away when the thread of the breaths will break, O man. The thread of the breaths will break. All the wealth and money will remain here when the extension of time for the breaths is finished. Pick up the body will be shouted in all directions, O man. The bird of life will fly away. Many came here before you, many have gone. All came empty-handed and went empty-handed. The five dacoits will loot you, O man. The bird of life will fly away. Doing me and mine, you will die in ego. You will stain the garb of this human body. O man, no force can stand before Kal. The bird of life will fly away. The way Satguru Ajay took Sadhu across, taking his refuge, O dear one, you can also swim across. Except the Guru, no one is yours, O man. The bird of life will fly away." Bhajan of Sadhu Ram, which will be sung now by Beverly Swan.
Ki mane kare taneta evite mitie sab sankata fakira ne eho kalali kie jado tute jani sahavali dor pandiya ute chanaye vajura vicho bor pandiya jado tute jani sahavali dor pandiya jado tute jani sahavali dor pandiya ute janaye vajura vicho bor pandiya ute janaye vajura vicho bor pandiya jado tute jani sahavali dor pandiya ete hi re janiyane janayate doleta mukha janiyane jado sahadiya moleta ete hi re janiyane janayate doleta mukha janiyane jado sahadiya moleta chako chako piju chare pase shore bandiya Chaco, chaco, piju, chare passe shore pandia, ute chanae, vajuda vicho porta pandia, ute chanae, vajuda vicho porta pandia, jado tuta jani, sahavali dora pandia, Jado tuta jani, sahavali dora pandia, uta janaye, vachuda vicho pora pandia, uta janaye, vachuda vicho pora pandia, jado tuta jani, sahavali dora pandia. Pela ke aite, kai chale kaine, kali hata leke aie, kali hata kayani. Pela kai aite, kai chale kaine, kali hata leke aie, Kali hate kayani luta laingaitenu luta laingaitenu luta laingaitenu panja chora pandia luta laingaitenu panja chora pandia Ute janaye vajuda vicho bora bandia. Ute janaye vajuda vicho bora bandia. Jado tuta jani sahavali dora bandia. Jado tuta jani Sahavali dora pandia uta janaye vajuda vicho bora pandia uta janaye vajuda vicho bora pandia jado tuta jani sahavali dora pandia Meri meri karitai, meche mara javinga, manasa choloni weve, dagatula vavinga. Meri meri karitai, meche mara javinga, manasa cholani weve, dagatula vavinga. Neo kaliage chalana koi jora pandia. Neo kaliage chalana koi jora pandia. Ute janaye vajuda vicho bora pandia. Ute janaye vajuda vicho bora pandia. Jado tuta jani sahavali dora pandia. Jado tuta jani sahavali dora pandia. Uta janaye vajuda vicho bora pandia. Uta janaye vajuda vicho bora pandia. Jado tuta jani sahavali dora pandia. Sati guru ajai bajive sadhu nu etaria peja tu sharanantara chavinga piaria. Sati guru ajai bajive sadhu nu etaria peja tu sharanantara javinga piaria. Neo Guru Binatera, Neo Guru Binatera, Neo Guru Binatera, Koi Hora Bandia, Neo Guru Binatera, Koi Hora Bandia, Udjana Eva Judo Vicho Bora Bandia. Utejana eva chura vicho bora bandia. Jado tutejani sahavali dora bandia. Jado tutejani sahavali dora bandia. Utejana eva chura vicho bora bandia. Utejana eva jura vicho bora bandia. Charo tutejani sahavali dora bandia.
Well, well, people, dear friends, this is this is very difficult for me this time. I will try to just give a few highlights of how my wife Judith and I met Judy Swart, as we called her then. And a good thing we did, because my wife's name was Judith, and it would have been very confusing. When I first met Judy Swart, she was 22 years old. I was 29. My wife Judith was 27. My daughter Miriam was 4. My son Eric was 2.5. And this ashram was 6 months old. Master Kripal had been here just 6 months before, founded the ashram to our, Judith and mine, astonishment. And we had followed him on much of his tour, and we were back, and the winter had passed, a very difficult winter, and spring had come. Now, when Master came in October 63, a number of people were waiting for him at the big house here, just outside the door, as he came up the path to the front door of the big house. There were a number of people. They were mostly lined up along the front of the house to greet him. And one of them was a man named Arthur Harvey, who was a friend. He was a follower of Mahatma Gandhi, or tried to be, and he published a newsletter called Greenleaf, to which Judith and I subscribed. And he liked to travel around and meet with all the people who subscribed to his newsletter and bring them together, make contacts between people. He enjoyed doing that. And he had Master's darshan that day, and he kept up his connection with us. And sometime in late spring of 1964, it was cold enough so we had a wood fire going, I remember, but it was not that cold. He stopped by and he said to me, "You know, you people really ought to get to know Judy Swart. She's over at the Fish in Laconia." And I said, "The Fish? What?" He said, "Well, it's a coffee house at the Congregational Church, and she's running it. It's her thing. She's doing it for the teenagers, and she's very, very good at it, and she has the same ideas you have." And I said, "Well, she sounds good." So we agreed, Judith and I agreed, that we would indeed get in touch with Judy Swart, and we did. And I went over to get her in my pickup truck that I had then. And I got into the coffee house, and I found her. She was sitting on the floor, cross-legged, guitar in her lap. leading a song, and then I heard some of the things she said, and I thought, gee. And she was such a beautiful young woman, and I thought, gee, this is somebody very special. And I drove her back to here, to the ashram, and we talked all the way back, and she loved the fact that the ashram was born on the same day that she was, October 11th, which is the day that Master came, and it was her birthday. So she came and she really never left. She just accepted everything. She loved the Master from the get-go. And she read all the books. She talked with Judith and me. And she was initiated the following fall. Mr. Khanna came up from Washington and initiated her and Gerald Boyce and Amy Sandville. And they were the fourth, fifth, and sixth initiates in this area, not counting Judith and me, who came from outside. David Wiggins was the first. Frank and Eleanor Irwin were the second and third. And Judy, Gerald, and Amy were the third, fourth, and fourth, fifth, and sixth. Excuse, I never was good at math. Anyway, then she left for a while. But the enormous thing that Judy did for us back then was in February of that 65, Judith and I went to India. We went to see Master Kripal and to attend the conference, which we had been invited to do. All the American satsangis were invited to do that. But very few satsangis went. But Judith and I really got into our heads. We really, really, really wanted to go. So my mother would not take the kids. She was not that healthy, and 3 weeks was a long, long time. And from her point of view, she had taken them many, many times, but for shorter stays. So we asked Judith Swart if she would do it. And God bless her, she said yes without a second's hesitation. You understand, this was in the middle of the winter in New Hampshire, of course. At that time, the ashram had no telephone. That was back when telephones were referred to by place, that this house has a telephone or whatever. Anyway, we didn't have anything like that. The running water was cut off in the winter because I was afraid the pipes would freeze. So we hauled water up from Sheehan Spring down on 127. And she would be there all alone with two little kids. And she had no problem with that. And because we wanted to go so bad, you know, we let her do it. We wanted her to do it. And, you know, that trip was a great, great blessing for us. But I'll tell you that Judith got just as much of a blessing from it as we did, because without her, it wouldn't have happened. And all of the things that followed, the growth of the ashram, subsequent trips, especially my 69 trip, which would have been very, very different if we had not gone in 65. Anyway, when we got back, she was very glad to see us. And we told her all about our trip. We told Master all about it too. I knew we were over there, and he gave us prasad for her and said to give her his very special blessing and thanks for doing this. And she was thrilled about that, and she stayed on. And we stayed on first for a while, all of us in the little house, because the big house was closed for the winter. Back then I used to do that. And eventually spread out more when the weather got better. During this period, Judith used to wake us up. I mean, we were all gung-ho about getting up for meditation, but Judith was the one who got up first and woke up Judith and me, my wife Judith and me. And I still remember she would read to us from the book, The Philosophy of the Masters, had just come out. And there was a chapter in it on the hour of elixir, the Amrit Vela, the ambrosial hour. And she used to read from that chapter, and I still remember hearing her reading, "Oh, thou beautiful moon-like seeker." This is one of the quotes from one of the bhajans that was included in the book. You know, arise, etc., etc. I still hear her voice saying that. Anyway, a lot of stuff happened. Judith was the first person, apart from my family, Judith, Miriam, and Eric, and me, to live here. She was the first Sevadar, and the first wise person that Judith and I could consult with about it. Later on, Gerald Boyce came, and he was also a wise person, and the four of us, Judith and me, and Judith, Swart, and Gerald, we often met together and discussed things. And Judith was very, very, very adamant that we should proceed and, you know, really make an ashram, because she said that's what Master wants. And you see, Judith, my Judith and I, were very hesitant to do that because we were very scared and bewildered the whole idea of running an ashram. How on earth do you do that? You know, what can you... Anyway, Judith was like our backbone in that regard. And I'll tell you, at the ashram, if Judith had not been here, the ashram would have taken a very different course than it did. She is as responsible for the present existence and condition and space of the ashram as anybody is. Anyway, a lot of memories and a lot of things, but I want to share with you something my sister wrote, who was also here during much of that time, and it sheds some light on what I was just talking about. My sister Helen, now living in the state of Washington, but at that time was here. She says, "Ah, those first couple of euphoric years when the ashram was young, and so were we. There was Russell and Judith in the little house, and Gerald Boyce, bless his heart, Judith Webb, then known as Judy Swart, and me in the big house. A little later, Jim Cluett arrived, whose memories of Judith will corroborate my own. This was in the year of our Lord, 1966, or year of our master in his ashram, 03. I first met Judith 2 years previously. I had been living in Seattle and had just completed 3 months of Peace Corps training in Milwaukee, with 10 days off before leaving for Brazil. I hadn't been home to New Hampshire in 3 years, during which time Master Kripal had come, and an ashram was born in New Hampshire. 5 of those 10 days break I spent at the ashram, and Judith was incredibly helpful to me in sharing so much about Master and the path. Her sincerity and devotion to the Master and the love between her and Russell and Russell's wife, Judith, were beautiful to see. As well, she poured her heart into making the big house a very special place for satsang and meditation. Of course, in those days, we didn't have a hall, and the big house was where we had satsang and meditation, except during the winter, first few years, when we had it in the little house, believe it or not. All this was very impressive to me. And when I left for Brazil, I knew that I wanted initiation when my 2-year Peace Corps tour was over. Judith's faithful, long, and informative letters were one of my very few lifelines during those 2 years. Master's circulars, stories of the Master, or anything that she thought would be a help in keeping Master in my thoughts, she sent to me. I still have some of those letters. She also described life there at Sant Bani Ashram. I could hardly wait to get home. And when I did, It was dear Judith Swart who accompanied me to Millie Prendergast's home in Brookline, Massachusetts, and sat with me at my initiation, the only person besides Millie who was with me during the most precious day of my life. The big house, you could say, became Judith's studio and easel. Her creativity was unbounded. Paper shades on the lamps, winterizing the big, uninsulated house, painting, building. Judith Perkins once remarked that the big house would collapse if Judy left. Her meditation nest in her room on the second floor was a work of wonder and devotion. The hours from 3 to 6 a.m. were sacred. Among other gifts to me, she built a square meditation bench, painted it brown, and in yellow letters wrote on it Master's quote, "Take heed, he is seeing, he is watching." Yes, indeed. On another occasion, she borrowed my new, unused as yet, electric typewriter and typed the entire long talk by Master Kripal's on Simran, more than 25 pages, and gave it to me as a Christmas gift. Of course, she did leave the ashram eventually. The big house didn't actually collapse, but a big part of it was definitely missing. In those early days, Russell and his wife Judith often used to lovingly call each other "sweetie head," which always made me smile. And somehow, perhaps by family extension, I was called Helen Head. Judith Webb gleefully latched on to my new nickname too, and for the next 55 years or so, that was what she called me, and that was how I always signed my name. A loving token of sacred memories. So, dear Judith, this is my last letter to you. You know, I will miss your smiling face. Greeting Russell and me while serving us lunch at the big house these last few Julys. I will miss your bhajan sung so beautifully, as well as the depth of understanding and friendship between us from the very beginning. What to speak of your sense of humor, devotion to Master, and your love for Russell and Judith. I am just so glad that Master allowed them to catch you in his net at the Fish Coffee House in 1964. And now Master, like an expert angler, as you secure ever more in his basket. My heartfelt love to you, dear sister. Helen Head. Well, sorry, I'm obviously having a difficult time processing all this. I know that Master does have Judith safely in his basket. I know that she is on his lap in Sachkhand. And I know that she is relieved of the terrible suffering that she went through. You know, some people leave. There's an enormous abyss created. The world is a much less benign place than it was when Judith was in it. And we can't help but feel that. I will say just a couple more things. One is, of course, that Judith, at the end of her life, found solace and inspiration and love at the feet of Sadhu Ram in India, who was functioning as Sanchi's successor. And, you know, she brought that inspiration and wisdom and love and solace back here and incorporated into the ashram. She spent long, long hours here in this hall meditating. She made as good use of the ashram as anybody ever has. And of course, counting over her whole lifetime, she probably made better use, all told, than anybody ever has. And she also went back to doing seva, as Helen pointed out in her letter. Most of the time that I've seen Judith lately, the last few years, has been when she served meals, either at the big house or sometimes I went down to her house too, and we talked, had long, good talks when that happened. Anyway, one of the things that I used to have Judith do when we held satsang was, in those days we didn't sing bhajans. We didn't know any, and we weren't capable of it. I mean, Judith was certainly capable of it, but we didn't know we were supposed to back then. But she had such a beautiful reading voice. I used to have her read either hymns from Kabir in Tagore's translation, or, things from Master's book on prayer, or his translation of the Japji, the famous long poem of Guru Nanak. And Judith would read that as the beginning of satsang before we did anything else. And it took the place of the singing the bhajans the way we do now. It began the satsang in that way. She did it so beautifully. Now when I read the Master's translation of the Japji, which I just did a few months ago, again, I've read it many, many times over the years. In certain sections of it, I can hear, I read them and I hear Judith saying them. And I was thinking that as I was reading, I cannot read those sections without both hearing her voice and seeing her as she sat there reading them. Anyway, this is one of the hymns of Kabir that she read then, and this has meant a great deal to her. And I'll conclude my remarks by reading this. Between the poles of the conscious and the unconscious, there has the mind made a swing. Thereon hang all beings and all worlds, and that swing never ceases its sway. Millions of beings are there. The sun and the moon in their courses are there. Millions of ages pass, and the swing goes on. All swing, the sky and the earth and the air and the water, and the Lord himself taking form. And the sight of this has made Kabir a servant. So I would ask Shipp if he would like to come up and say a few words.
Well, it's really great to hear about the early days of Judith. And I regret very much that I didn't know her then. But I was married to her for 40 years. And in thinking about this talk, I realized I could not summarize those 40 years easily or without great pain. So I want to share one brief incident that I think shows the essence of what Judith was. But before that, before I get to that, I want to say that, and several people have commented on this, that there's never a good day for your wife of 40 years to die. But if you were going to pick a time, this would be it. Because as we've heard, Judith was woven into the fabric of the ashram, and her death was woven into the fabric of the ashram. The whole timing of it was perfect. Russell was here to talk about the past. And, of course, the timing was perfect. By the time we could make the arrangements, the retreat was winding down. The tent would be available for one more day. And so it's been an amazing experience to me that to go through this. A lot of people have come up to me and said, "How are you doing?" And I would basically say, "Fine," because I felt like I was just buoyed along by all old friends, brothers and sisters, as I went through this, plus family members. And if it had been any other week, it wouldn't have been like that. I wouldn't have had that support. I might have had Mira and Kate and a few other people at home, but there wouldn't have been this big crowd of people that I have, you know, long connections of going to India and meditating here and going on tours with. So that was a great blessing. And I also have to say that the whole disease of Judas started 10 months ago. And it's another thing I could not have done alone without the help of her daughter Mira and her sister Kate, who Mira was here. It took a lot of time off from her job in Tennessee, a high-pressure administrative job at East Tennessee University. She came, and we did shifts of caring for Judith. Kate came over from Vermont for 3 days, many weeks, and kind of gave us a break and also filled in and also brought a lot of knowledge of hospice, which she had done. And so I'm completely grateful, greatly appreciative of all the help they gave me, because it could not have been done without her. And I also should mention Kate's husband, Ed, because Kate would come over leaving a recently retired husband, a llama, a horse, a garden, and many birds to feed. But Ed, who is the recently retired husband, adopted to the new role, took over the care of these animals and other things, and encouraged her to come. So I'm grateful to you, Ed, for allowing her to do that. It was a big help. Now, I'm coming to this incident of Judith. I think most people know this. There may be a few that don't know, but many of us here have made many trips to India to visit with either Kripal Singh or other masters. And for around 20 years, people went to see Sanchi. And usually that was in the state of Rajasthan in India, but it was also in some of the cities. And Judith and I ended up going for several years to Bombay. And the format of these trips was that the group would come, and there'd be a group meditation with Sanchi, and there would be another session where he would answer questions in the group, and there would be another session where he would give a talk. And there would be a session where we sang these bhajans. But there was also a private interview where you could go in individually or as a couple. And so the time came once in Bombay that Judith and I went into our interview, and to make this whole process efficient, the organizers had you write out your questions on a piece of paper, because it all had to be translated. So one time, I don't remember what year this was, but we went into our interview and we gave this little, our handwritten question to the translator. But Sanchi didn't really pay any attention to them. And he immediately spoke to us directly. And he said, "When you first came to see me, you did not impress me very much." But and we sort of held our breath for a bit. And then he said, "But now, I am more impressed with you, especially you, Judith." Especially you, Judith. And Judith was impressive. For a long time in Tennessee, where we lived for about 30 years, She got up at 1:30 in the morning to meditate. She meditated more than me. She learned all of Sanchi's bhajans and practiced them every day. She slept less than me. She ate less than me. And she avoided some of my bad habits, like watching sports into the night. And she related everything to the teachings of the master. Like if I said a cold front was coming and there would be showers, she would say, no, the master has decided that these flowers need watering. So, summarizing this, I think that her impressing the master is her greatest accomplishment. It shows how hard she worked and for how long and how deeply spiritual, how loving of God and other people and other animals she was. And toward the end of her life, she said, maybe I'll inspire somebody. But she, at that point, she was referring to her disease, that she was leading her ordinary life, following her routines, until she got a pain one day after satsang. And by the end of the day, she was in the Laconia hospital and was told there was a mass on her pancreas and liver, and then later it was diagnosed as being stage 4. So what she meant when she said this was that you can be living your daily life, but it can change in a second. The bottom can fall out. And she meant that the message to people was what the masters always say, live in the moment. Your time is short. You don't have, what was the bhajan today? You have very little time. But as I think about that, all impressing the master shows that there are many aspects to her that can inspire us. And I hope that there's somebody here that is inspired by Judith.
Okay.
I loved my sister. She always told me the story in our family is that she kept telling my mom and dad that she was going to have a baby sister. So she had an older brother, and he was 5 years older. Anyway, she kept saying, you know, I want a baby sister, you're going to have one. And my parents in the early 50s moved to Vermont from New Jersey. My mom didn't do pregnancy well. They moved to the boonies, really. And what happened is my mother got pregnant. Judith was 10 at the time. So my mother was in her mid-40s. And, you know, when she got pregnant, she would say to my sister, well, how do you know it's going to be a girl? And she said, well, I just know it's going to be a girl. And sure enough, I was born. And so in your story, Russell, of Judith taking care of your children, I think that Judith, since I was, you know, born when she was 10, she took care of me. She, you know, was more than an older sister. And from everything that's been said about her so far, you know, she was a lot of person, you know. So I grew up with her. Just being amazing to me as a sister. And she was there at every moment that was hard in my life and not hard. And, you know, she was amazing, really. And I feel really blessed that I got to spend time with her at the end of her life. And it was, you know, my husband had retired and I could come, and I did. And we had some really special moments. And so I just want to tell one story. Our mom was a huge animal lover, all animals, little tiny things to really big things. And Judith got it, I got it, my brother got it. My brother has 14 indoor cats. but growing up, when I was a little kid, you guys all know what spiders are. There was this spider that lived at the top of our stairs, and it was a barn spider. And if you don't know what a barn spider looks like, they're huge. And he was up by this light at the top of our stairs, and we had a guest house. So there were people that would come and rent rooms, and they'd have to walk by this spider. His name was Joe. And so my mother, of course, had to feed him and water him. And so we grew up putting flies and spraying Joe with water. And again, if anybody who's been to my sister's house knows, on every windowsill and in every room, there are multiple spray bottles. And it's not just for plants. It's for ladybugs, it's for whatever, and it's for spiders. And the most beautiful thing of this is when I was coming over to be with her at the end of her life, is I go in and use her bathroom, and I'd sit down, and there's a spray bottle right in front of me, and you would take that spray bottle, and there was a little spider that comes out right next to this cupboard, and you'd spray him every morning. And so I've been doing that, and I hope that you guys continue to do that, and I hope whenever anyone here uses a spray bottle or isn't using a spray bottle, decides to use one, remember my sister. Thank you.
Mira?
Hi, everybody. I didn't get a chance to text Vera to just ask if I can't do this. Will you? Okay. I'm going to try. Thanks. It's kind of long. Before I read this, I'll first apologize to Ship if it's too long. We talked about we want to give other people a chance, but I'm kind of taking a big part of that time. So before I start, I first need to say that Mom has really, really good timing. If she was going to die, which is the tragedy of my life, at least she did it when all of you could be here. This week here at the ashram has been, like Ship said, we've been buoyed by everybody. And I'm going to forget everybody who helped, but Susan Diamond, who came to pick me up after I had been here for several weeks, and then Mom made me go home, and I went home for 48 hours, and then Ship called and said, you need to come back. Susan drove to Boston and picked me up in the rain on June 13th, and she has basically done everything that you can possibly imagine to make sure that today, what you're going to witness today, goes as beautifully as it is and will. And everyone here at the ashram, and Kate and Ship and our family members who are here, Kate's husband Ed, and Susan's granddaughters, Lila and Vivian, have been amazing. And I'm going to forget Fletcher and having Russell here, all of it. I actually think that if this hadn't happened now, I think it would actually traumatize me even worse. So this is really important. Not everybody gets to have some community like this in a retreat happening times like this when they lose their mom, but I think everybody should. Anyway, something Mom used to say many times over the years that came, I think, she thought, from Kirpal Singh, was this phrase, "Oh, sorrowful matter." For her, that encompassed a lot of how she felt, and that would be coupled with long conversations about life, about death, and about all the living creatures that she loved and cared for, and about the world. You all know about the birds and the plants and the gardens, the squirrels, deer, butterflies that Mom took such good care of. But I wrote this before I knew what Kate said. Did you know my mom fed house spiders things like water, apple cores, and her own spit and spray bottles? I mean, I've literally seen her, if she couldn't find a spray bottle, spit on her hand and make sure that spider was going to drink something, and she would say, well, in a regular ecosystem, there's going to be moisture, but the house is too dry. She instructed me to never remove webs from the corners of the ceilings. And in fact, I didn't write this, but recently she informed me that she discovered that there were some very, very tiny, tiny little bugs that lived in the wood of the house. And I said, termites? And she said, no, it's some kind of dust mite. And she discovered that the little bit of dust that comes off her hair when she brushes it was something they like to eat. And I said, Mom, how did you figure that out? And she said, oh, trial and error. So... oh, Mom, your breath, soft in my hair, breathing your scent, craving it, your touch, your musical voice, with so many melodious inflections and extra lilting hums given like small kisses of reassurance, like liquid sunshine in my ear. Your voice, your songs, constant, like birds singing all day, so precious to me. Even at the end, when all you could do was whisper, okay, sweetie, or no, or yes. The heartbreaking shift in the cadence of Ship's voice on the phone that day last year, right around Labor Day, when he called to tell me you were hospitalized after collapsing in excruciating pain. I was just leaving Wisconsin, where I had installed a solo exhibition of my paintings, and I had a long road trip ahead of me, and Ship and me talked on and off throughout. Sitting in my car, one of many of your gently used but still awesome cars that you and Chip gave me, at a truck stop under the most extraordinary pink and violet and orange sunset somewhere on the road, Chip told me the house was so silent without your constant humming and bhajans. His voice cracked with uncertainty and fear, and I knew then that we had already entered an altered space. I think I tried not to cry too hard on the phone. We both were terrified we were going to lose you right then. Oh, sorrowful matter. Mom always made the most magical spaces for me from my arrival to her home, replete with softness, lovely, rich fabrics, always something new, something nostalgic, decorated, arranged, little things, trinkets, things with hearts, or things with rainbows and unicorns when I was little. And for my whole life, she tucked cash away into my pockets and wallet and hands and in cards and letters and plastic Easter eggs and once folded tightly in each small compartment of a gorgeous hand-carved wooden box she found at a crafts fair, complete with a secret hidden chamber containing a crisp folded $100 bill. Being Judith's daughter was like being showered with tiny, sparkling bits of invisible radiant starlight, given in thousands of ways whenever I needed it, without ever asking. But if I asked, she made it her focus to help me throughout the very darkest times. I always needed her, and in times I struggled, the times I struggled with despair that was unlike anything I had ever known, I gathered her close, and she did the same with me. Many of you know that leaving here in 1979 was one of the great heartbreaks of my life. But the rabbit hole I fell into opened up into a new life with Mom and Ship as they made their home in Suwanee, Tennessee. That place, especially the house that they built there on the edge of the bluff looking out over Lost Cove, was about as good as it gets and contributed in making leaving this idyllic place of my childhood not quite as tragic as it could have been. They lived there almost 30 years, and that community is another loving home to me. I'm going to share a small anecdote about my life right now as a small way of helping you understand my mom. In doing so, you will see I include Ship in much of this because as partners, they were partners in the very best sense of the word, shoulders to the wheel, moving the carriage forward as one. In early 1997, when I was 27, I was kind of a mess. I was paralyzingly, deeply, unflaggingly sad. I had moved from New Hampshire to Florida and worked for Papa for a while, which was amazing, but I pretty much hated being in Florida. It wasn't my place. Ship and Mom opened their home to me, and I moved back to Tennessee again for the first time since high school. Their example of hard work every day became the way forward for me, and I did my very best to follow their good example and that of Papa and my other mother, Christine. Working for them in the daytime in their jewelry studio and waiting tables at night, I got out of debt, saved money, applied to graduate schools. Of course, it all worked out. I got my MFA at the University of Georgia, and after that, a professorship at East Tennessee State University in Johnson City, and where I live and work today. From then until now, Mom and Chip always supported me on every level. And you know what that means if you're a Gen X kid or if you raised one. It means money, lots of money, and forgiveness for all of my many failures, and constant, unflagging encouragement, belief in me, support, all of it. Having a family of fiercely disciplined, brilliantly creative artists, all of them, Papa, Christine, Chip, Judith, who make a living at what they do, is pretty fantastic. And most of you know I'm talking about all my parents when I say that. I was told that my mother was in labor for a really long time when she was pregnant with me. She gave birth to me at home in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. My birth was documented in a series of extraordinary photographs, which you will not see on the photo board at the reception later, but which have been the source of great awe and wonderment for me ever since Papa found them and made a set of copies for me a few years ago. In some of these images, Mom looks like a Renaissance painting of a saint, hands upturned, pale, thin, exhausted, surrendering to what, for those of us who have not experienced it, is an unimaginable process, that of giving birth. They said I was a big baby, and I've always imagined the reason Mom lost weight and I was so big and healthy is because I sucked it out of her. On the day that I watched Mom's breaths go from labored and fast to slower, slower, until gently, quietly, imperceptibly they stopped. A memory came to me in those last few minutes of her life, of her quiet, diminishing breaths. It is of a story my parents told me, they used to tell me, about when I was a toddler, in that phase when toddlers figured out they can get away from their parents, and I was always running away from them, and we were on the beach on the ocean in Fort Lauderdale, and I kept running away. And at some point, Papa said to Mama, he said, just let her go, she'll come back. And as they tell me the story, I kept running a little farther and turning around and looking. And they stayed and waited, and Mom was getting anxious, and then I went a little farther and turned around again. Kept going a little farther until I was pretty far away. And they always said I was like a little speck, but I doubt I was that far away. And apparently I did come back because nobody snatched me up. I'm here. But I was watching her slip away from the world, and I could see myself, this little baby. I could see myself from her eye viewpoint, knowing that she wasn't coming back. And I just thought, wow. It wasn't lost on me that I was watching her go farther and farther from me, watching her die. I knew she wasn't coming back, unlike her on that day. Mothers and daughters let each other go in many, many ways, but I think this may be the hardest, at least if you have a mother like I did. Over the last several weeks, Mom became more and more dependent on us as her body slowly shut down, making it almost impossible for her to eat. But I spoon-fed her bits of yogurt and applesauce, tapioca pudding, vanilla ice cream, chai, juice, and her last sustenance of choice when she could no longer eat, cold ginger ale through a straw. She couldn't walk at the end, and she rarely opened her eyes, but she was still lucid, answering us sometimes, and just in an unimaginable amount of pain, managed very well by the drugs she never wanted to have to take at the end. She would sit up in bed often, eyes closed, sometimes for hours at a time, back straight. Her belly was pressing painfully outward with the rapidly growing tumors, which drained every bit of her, which had to be terrifying. Oh, sorrowful matter. I couldn't help but notice that she again looked like the suffering saints of those paintings, pale, thin, exhausted, surrendering to that unimaginable process of leaving this mortal coil. That frail body that had been so strong only 10 months before, that body that had undergone hip replacement only a couple of years ago, And within 3 months of that surgery, she had been shoveling snow again. Her white shining hair, her piercing eyes of love, her velvet skin, lips that knew how to give the best sweet kisses. I could never be near her enough. I could never get enough. I am so grateful that I was able to spend so many weeks here, thanks to my job, watching my most dear love suffer from this painful disease brought us all to our knees. Shipp, who is one of the very best men I have ever known and who has been another father to me, and Kate, Mom's sweet and endlessly loving sister who shares all of Judith's great qualities of selflessness, discipline, humility, and gentle kindness. And me, we did our very best to care for her, to give her love and comfort in every way we could, to attend to her needs on every level. Over that time, I came to learn, to gain a much more fully fleshed out picture of the marriage of two people I thought I understood. Shipp and Judith were one of the greatest couples I have ever known. Their life together was epic, and they worked so hard to always adhere to the principles of the path. And as Shipp told me recently, to ask for forgiveness of each other over and over. In the last several years, I heard constantly from Mom how happy she was and how loving and doting and sweet Shipp was, and I saw it with my own eyes. But in the last several months, I saw a man who accepted his wife for all of who she was, and as she struggled in her final chapter, he honored her by fiercely and steadfastly adhering to what she wanted, down to every detail. I know what love is. I watched him demonstrate it, and I know that Mom felt secure and carried his constant care. I have one more thing to share. I could talk forever. I was named Mira after Mirabai, Mom's idea. Mirabai, you all know about Mirabai, the great Bhakta, the one who sang all the beautiful songs, whose name, as I understand it, means one who loves God like a moth to the flame. I grew up reading the songs of Mira over and over, marveling at her descriptions of Krishna as a lover she wanted to be taken by and her relentless fixation on death. One legend says that she disappeared when she died, that she literally disappeared and left only a sari behind in a temple. Another says that only her hair was left. My mother wanted me to love God. She wanted me to be spiritual. That was her wish for me, and that was why she chose that name. And I tried. I really, really tried very hard to be a good disciple. But in the end, she was the devoted disciple that I could never be. She's left us her many shawls and blankets, and I took a couple of locks of her hair after she was gone and after I lay with her body holding her for as long as I needed. I want you all to know that over 10 years ago, with great trepidation, I told Mom and Shipp that I was stepping over here off to the side of the path, that I prefer to think of myself as agnostic, meaning without knowledge, but that my stepping away was never a stepping against. I told her I have love for the Master, but that it is right for me to say, I am without knowledge, I do not know. I had been so afraid to tell her because I didn't want to disappoint her and I didn't want her to feel like she had failed. Her response to me was, honey, I already knew. I made peace with this knowledge because I've put all my eggs in this basket. Therefore, I believe that not a leaf turns without the will of the Master. You're doing exactly his will, and I'm proud of you, honey. I'm proud of what you've done with your life. So you see, she was the true Mirabai, the true Bhakta, the true lover. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with not being that. And she made it okay by responding the way she did, enabling us to have this last decade as mother and daughter and as friends with as true and close and bonded of an intimate relationship that could be. Her forgiveness, capacity for grace, and a tiny little leap of faith on my part made what could have been a very tough thing feel relatively painless. And to me, that is holy. So I'm going to end with two brief readings. The first one is one of many beautiful love poems from Ship to Mom that I have discovered mixed in with boxes of family photos I've been poring over. And I'm reading it with Ship's permission. It's from February 14th, 1986. And it says, "Water falls and freezes on the cold rocks. Dust settles on the furniture. Pigeons huddle in their caves. Somehow I don't notice in my warm home with you." The second reading is from one of my mom's journals that I have been reading through from an India trip in the 80s. "Singing a bhajan in front of the saint, trembling voice, empowered, belief, relief, excuse me, empowered, relief. He loves me. He calls me by my name, Judith." Thank you.
Eric? Is Eric here?
He's coming.
Okay. John's way in back.
Whew. Oh, this is quite something, being here with you all. Well, you heard about how Judith took care of some kids in 1965. I was one of those kids. I wrote down a few memories. As my dad explained earlier, Judith lived with our family at the ashram for certain periods in the early to mid-60s, when I was between about 3 and 6 years old, and my sister Miriam was just a little older. Judith was great to us kids. We just loved her. I remember she gave me a blue dump truck on either my 4th or 5th birthday, that I absolutely loved. Unfortunately, I left it in the driveway one too many times, and it got run over one day. I was devastated. My parents kindly bought me a replacement truck, which was okay, but it wasn't the same. I remember pining for the blue one for months after. I suspect part of the reason was the love that came with that truck. The other part might have been that Judith had a great eye for handsome dump trucks. Another memory is from 1965, when Judith was looking after Miriam and me while our parents were in India, the famous 3-week period that we heard about. At one point, Miriam reached for a big can of honey on a shelf above her head, and the lid came off as she was tipping it towards her. Practically the whole can spilled out into her hair. I remember watching Judith calmly, gently, and thoroughly washing the honey out of her hair in the kitchen sink, a project that was made even more challenging given we didn't have running water in the house yet. Judith was bringing it up from the spring, as we heard earlier, in the wintertime, which this was. When my parents were preparing the application for me to attend first grade at Horizon's Edge School in Canterbury, this was before St. Bonnie's School had been started, a written recommendation was needed from someone other than the child's parents. A few years ago, I came across the recommendation Judith wrote for me. Judith was in her early 20s, and she wrote me a remarkably deep and glowing recommendation, one that I later thought might have practically been appropriate for my college applications. I couldn't find it this week, but I hope to discover it again someday. It reminded me of how big a part Judith played in my early childhood years and what a great presence she was in my life. More recently, I remember loving her write-ups on birds and wildlife in the Peario Home newsletter. When I'd see her name in the table of contents, I'd jump right to that every time. The other stuff was good too, don't get me wrong. But I was always most eager to read her accounts of various species sightings and details of habitat enhancement work underway, etc. Late last summer, I had the pleasure of having lunch with Judith here at the ashram not long before her cancer diagnosis. I had just returned from visiting the cemetery here and remarked to Judith that I had seen the recently installed marker stone for Bob Pearsall and how I liked that it said, "Gone home." With a twinkle in her eye and without missing a beat, she said, "I want mine to say, my turn." So perfect, I thought. I don't know what will actually end up on her marker stone, but I'm happy for her that she did indeed get the turn she wanted. It's certainly sad for us, but I'm confident she is happy now. Thank you.
Is John here?
Yes, John is here.
Okay, John Engel.
Kind of start with a short quote from the New Testament. "May my joy be in you, and may your joy be perfect." From John 15:11. So this is a little story that Miriam, Russell's other child, his daughter, told me. And I might have mangled a few details, but here it goes. Back before there was a satsang hall at Sant Barney Ashram, and before there was a pond, before Master's house was built, and before the East Field was a field, a very young woman went for a long walk into the Sant Barney woods, a woman with a deep love of God and of nature. Somewhere in a remote spot deep in those woods, she found an apple tree that had the most delicious apples. Gathering an armload of those apples, she excitedly ran back to everyone else at the ashram, who was probably only the Perkins family, to share those apples. What a miracle! Big, juicy apples from an apple tree in the middle of a jungle. That very young woman was, of course, the person we know now as Judith Webb. And what a miracle she became! A strong, quiet presence, a presence of inspiration, of hope, and of love and service in a world of harsh chaos. That apple tree is gone now. There's a cemetery where it once stood. So too is Judith gone, gone from our eyes. I don't know where the soul of that apple tree is gone, but I know that Judith has moved to a far, far better world. You are missed, Judith, very much. Even the birds miss you. So travel home safely and swiftly, my dear friend and sister. You are in very good hands, very strong hands. And may your joy now be perfect. Thank you.
All right. My name is Fletcher Loki. I live here at the ashram. And I'm going to call on some more people to talk. But first I want to read a letter sent by Marlene McCarty, who could not be here and wished to have this read today. She says, "I am sorry not to be able to be here. I would have loved to share in the energy of Judith's many loved ones' memories. When I think of Judith, I think of flowers and birds, nature and kindness. From the old pet cat that she and Ship nursed for over a year, who needed so much attention, to the lowliest of insects, the crickets that found their way into the house that she cared for. She was a true example of a real friend, always ready, day and night, in the most frigid mornings before dawn to feed the wildlife outside in her zoot suit and headlamp. Remarking on this bird or that bear, her well-nourished flock of turkeys, the skunk family, all the animals that came to her fairy tale home. It was a home full of love and light. In so many ways, she was able to share her depth of understanding and love. So many days did she usher me into my room, quote unquote, at the end of her hall, and every morning as I stumbled into the living room at 2:30 a.m., already there was my chai thermos, delicious ginger chai, with a sticky note on it, and my favorite cup. Then we could sit and share some moments of thoughts and the pleasure of each other's company before we went on to meditate by 3 a.m. And then in the evening, again, with her and Ship at their favorite spots by the stove. They were always welcoming, always able to extend me a hand with my bags and help in countless ways. I learned a lot by being with her. There were so many trips together to the master's programs, and so many beautiful times. And then in those final days, seeing all the wonderful notes and pictures of the beautiful soul that she is. Yes, she will be missed in this life, and looking forward to connecting with her again in our onward and upward journey. With love to all the family and friends, I am grateful, Marlene. And now the family would like to invite others who would wish to speak, to come and share with us. And I would ask, please be mindful that there are a lot of people who have shared love with Judith and may wish to speak. So try to speak to the essence of what you have to say. So is there someone else who would like to speak?
Yes.
I'm sorry? Russell? Oh, okay. Jonas, please.
Thank you.
Yeah. I missed you.
Thank you. Hi. Wow, full house. Well, I'm amazed. That's wonderful. When I finished my search for a true master and I found Kripal, I gave up my whole hippie life, which was pretty intense, and decided that I can't do this alone. I'm going to have to find somebody to marry. And I looked around, and back in 1965, and there was hardly anyone. There were two ladies. The one I chose was Judith. Didn't know her, but I knew she was so devoted to the Master, so taken by doing his will. And I've came here, spent some time with Russell and Judith, and with Russell's sister, Helen, shared with Helen, I need to marry somebody, and I think it's going to be Judith. She says, all right. She coached me and didn't know how to do it. She didn't know me. I didn't know her. But she showed me her room with all the quotes of the Master and all what she does. She got up in the middle of the night, literally before it was middle of the night. Shortly after midnight, she was in meditation, putting in 5-6 hours a day, even more. I was so impressed by that. I said, I want to be like her. So hopefully if I to marry her, pick up her good habits. So I didn't know how to approach her, and Helen said, she's washing dishes now, it's a good time. Really? Yes, go on. But I don't know what to say, just say what you feel. Really? Just say it. oh my God. So I said, Judith, yes, can I ask you something? Yes, what is it? She was wrong. Yes, what is it? I would like to marry you. I think I shocked her. I shocked myself. It took a long time for her to grasp what this meant, and for me too. And eventually she said yes. It was a major transformation in her life that she was so close to here, and a major transformation in my life. We were so different, and yet somehow very connected. It was like a wild psychedelic hippie marrying a nun. It was incredible. But somehow we made it work. It wasn't easy, but we made it work. My life wasn't about the arts. Her life was about God. The arts and God. But we had something in common, the Master. We both got initiated by Kirpal Singh, and we both wanted to meet him so badly. So she tried to get a job in India so she could find a visa of some kind and get a job there. Didn't work, because lots of women over there could do what she did, what she could do. So when we got married, we wanted to go to India and meet him. And we got accepted by the Master, sold our vehicle, sold this, sold everything we could so we could make the trip. By then, Nir was a year and a half old. And she learned to walk in India. And we took that journey and said, as long as you're okay, sometimes it's difficult out there with a little girl. He said, we'll be okay. And we arrived, and he wasn't there. He was on tour somewhere. So we had a few days to wait. And while we were waiting, we had a little bit of an accident in a grocery store. I tried to make it short. And her finger was all wrapped up. She had injured her finger. And it was in a big bandage. And we met Master. Looking at him, he looked at us. He says, glad you're here. Glad you're here. Thank you. And he says, Sushil. He named her Sushil. Sushila for the woman, Sushila for the man. Mirabai, Sushila. And we were so cautious about her little hand. He went and said, so good! She's good, wonderful! And I said, Master, she called you Iya. Iya, that's very good. He just grabbed it was a club of something. You know, it was amazing how his energy was so different than what we expected. And we came, we spent 3 months there, the most glorious 3 months of my life. And when we came back, I got very involved in the arts. And so did she. She became very good at expressing herself on paintings. And I was amazed. She, being connected to the Master so deeply, had connected with a creative energy in the universe coming through the Master into a piece of canvas. And she was absolutely incredible. She would do these shapes, geometrical shapes, and experimenting with acrylics and water and some drops of chemicals. And it would be so beautiful. And she did one after the other, after the other, after the other, dozens, if not hundreds. And that superimposed a figurative thing, little boy, a little girl, you know, children, this and that thing, street scenes. We went to Europe for photographing street scenes together. She helped me photograph my clients doing portraits. She really got involved in the art of and making a spiritual statement in every situation. She would create a canvas with dark on the bottom and light on top. We used that for several paintings. Always reaching towards something higher. And she and I had a wonderful, for the time that it lasted, joint system of creating together. It was just amazing. And that came to an end, like everything else in life. And we separated. We had a big, different lifestyle. We all both agreed on that. It was very hard for me. She was only 11 years old. broke her heart. And I wish it didn't happen that way, but it did. And her life changed completely, and my life changed completely. And I didn't get to see her as much as I would have liked to, because her life began afresh with Chip, who was the most perfect husband for who she was. I was too much, too different, demanding too much. Her life as a spiritual person was that she was dedicated to the Master. I was dedicated to art with the Master. But her life was him and only him. So you could see there was some stuff, and I surrendered, and we both separated. We thought it was for the best, except it wasn't for the best for Mira. Nonetheless, Chip was, and Judith were a perfect couple. A lot better union than I ever was. And I'm so grateful to Chip for taking care of her so delicately, so gently, the way he did. He nurtured her. He accepted her the way she was. I had a hard time with that. She had accepted him the way he was. Very beautiful relationship. I don't think I've ever seen a spiritual couple more perfectly suited for each other as Judith and Chip. But I didn't miss her. And during the retreats, I would want to look at her, but it wasn't possible. It wasn't really the right thing, because I wanted to see her. And last year, I came to the retreat, and I was packing my bag. Something very incredible happened. I hear somebody say behind me, "Jonas?" I didn't recognize that voice. I turned around, and it was Judith. And I looked at her after not seeing her face for 40 years. And she was the most beautiful soul I've ever seen in my life. And her eyes were Kripal's eyes, 1,000%. And I was shocked. I didn't know what to say. And she said, "I just want to share with you how wonderful Mira is doing. She's in her art. She's developing this, and I was shocked. And the only other time I've seen eyes like her, who was other than the Master, was in India in 1969. Sanji had an old disciple, who I was told was at the same place that Sanji was. Except he wasn't commissioned to be a master. He was just a sevadar, a helper. His name was Sadam Ratan Singh. Nadar Ratan Singh. A sweet old man, but I looked at his eyes, I would go to him, and of course I couldn't speak Hindi, and I would say, "Sanji, you eyes, Sanji, anyone, it's all his grace. And I never saw anybody else other than the Master with those eyes, except when Judith came to me, the only time. And I'll never forget that. She had developed so deeply as a disciple of the Master, so profoundly, so courageously, so selflessly to become as much as possible as one can be like him. And I'm so grateful she gave me that 6, 7, 8 seconds last year during the retreat. I was, of course, I wanted more, but it wasn't her choosing. She gave me what I needed. And that's the best memory I have of Judith, who was my wife for about 12 years and then continued on with Chip and Judith in Sewanee, Tennessee, and then back here on Osgood Road. Thank you.
All right, someone else?
All right. I will call on Susan Diamond to read another letter from someone who could not be here. I'm sorry. Oh, I missed. I guess the hands are not getting up enough. I missed you, Steve. Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say one thing about what I remember about Judith. And in the past few days, I've been trying to find the right words for that. Was not successful until I remembered something that Santa Jaipsingji had said in one of his talks so many years ago. He said, when the soul reaches the higher planes beyond mind and matter, it is humbled by the countless great souls that have reached there before it and is inspired by their love and devotion. So thinking about this, it occurred to me that if love of God is what makes a soul great, and I think it is, then maybe we don't have to wait until we get to the higher planes to be both humbled and inspired. There are souls here in this physical world who are also loving God very, very much. And from what I could tell, Judith was one of them. When talking to Judith, inevitably the conversation would turn to the Master, and when she spoke of Kirpal Singh or Ajay Singh or Sadaranji, often her eyes would fill with tears and her voice would fail her. Her love of the Masters gave a lot of force and weight to the words that she spoke and to the bhajans that she sung, and they left an indelible impression. I will miss that about Judith very much. In my experience, this is not common, and it seems the light in this world does dim a bit somehow when such a soul like her leaves it. But it may be some consolation knowing that when we do reach those higher planes, and we will, and we see all those great souls who have preceded us, Judith will also be among them, no doubt waiting to greet us with tea and a plate of cookies, saying, "Welcome home." And I look forward to the day.
Did you want to speak, Lord? Right. Just a minute. Oh, sorry. Okay.
So I have many very fond memories of Judith. But I just want to share a couple. My first time meeting Judith, my brother and I were at the Maddies, and Larry was taking us on rides in his man lift. And Ship and Judith were there watching and visiting with the Maddies, and I had a very brief interaction with them. But I remember going home so excited that they were moving here because Judith had the most amazing energy, and Ship as well. But I just was so excited to be able to spend more time with them and was just so happy just based on that very brief interaction. And my first impression proved to be very accurate as Judith became like a grandmother to Caden and I. And even for our birthdays every year, she would invite us over for a birthday party. And she always sent us home with a personal cake. And one year, Caden and Jasmine and I were left home alone, and we had a personal cake, and we ate the entire thing for breakfast. We appreciated Judith very much for that. It was a very good, day. And I felt so comfortable with Judith and Ship. I remember one time my brother and my mom got bit by a dog and had to go to the hospital. And I was very, very worried, and the first person that I thought to call was Judith. And she came over and brought me to her house, and I remember her offering me food and water and anything, and she just comforted me so lovingly. I definitely made the right decision calling her, and I'm so grateful for everything. And then everybody has been mentioning how much she cared for animals, so I won't go into that too much, but I just want to say my personal favorite was she was explaining to us when we were coming over to learn about where she wanted us to shovel. And it was very important that we shoveled out under a rock because there was a mouse that lived there and she needed to be able to put out sunflower seeds for that mouse. And that was my personal favorite. And the last very fond memory I have of her was she showed me her heart collection when I was her heart rock collection when I was very young, and I was just mesmerized by it. And I asked her, "Where are you finding all these heart rocks?" And she said that she finds most of them walking to and from satsang on the way to the ashram. And so every once in a while, when I'm coming to satsang, I just find myself glancing down looking for heart rocks. And I know I'm going to continue to do that, and I'm always going to think of her. And the last thing I want to say is I want to address what Chip said, and I just want to say that Judith has inspired me. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to try to make this short. I just want to tell a story. I didn't know Judith for all the years that many of you have, but we met in 2003 in Mexico when Sadaram was here on his first tour. So most of my connection has been with her since then and on the board at Piario Home. So I just want to tell you a little story about one of our visits to India. When you go to India, in Delhi, at Sadaram's ashram, and you can't sit on the floor for hours, you're given a chair and a section in the back. This is a section where Judith and I would park ourselves. And there were politics to deal with back there, as where you sat rotated, and some people didn't like giving up their seats. I always knew I could exchange a glance and a smile with Judith as the mind showed up in full force. We're also on the board together, and it gave me great comfort to know that she and her wisdom were always there. And there are many things I could say about her warmth, her wisdom, her devotion, and her loving kindness, but I want to tell you a fun story, which will always be a great memory. In 2017, six of us from New Hampshire and Vermont went to Delhi to see Sadaram and partake in his birthday celebration. Hundreds of people ate cake, this ginormous cake, in celebration, and I was so impressed that she went back for a second piece. So many people had cake, and I thought, next time, I'm going to be that brave and ask for more. The day that we were to leave, Beth Hamill and myself and Judith were sitting together in the langar, and just in Master's grace, we were very, very giddy. And for some reason, placing G at the end of every word became a source of uproarious laughter. Judith G, as they were passing out food, it was rice G, chapati G. And Beth and I, both being gigglers, got laughing hysterically. Basically, we couldn't stop. And we got Judith going. And the three of us just couldn't stop laughing. And this behavior was to carry on for hours. But in the meantime, in our transit back to the U.S., we had a layover in Frankfurt where the security did not mess around in the airport. And we were all together in a group. There were six of us, but somehow we got separated. And Judith got whisked away into a room with some other people, some other men that were being pulled aside for interrogation. And when I say interrogation, they were interrogating. And we didn't know what had happened. It had just happened very suddenly. And I think Steve was waiting for her, but the rest of us met in this room. And she came up, and she was very clearly upset and distraught by the whole situation. And I kept thinking, Maybe it was that vest she wore with all those little pockets in it. Did they think it was explosive devices? Here was this older woman with beautiful, long, gray pigtails being pulled aside to be interrogated. So that was part of the trip. And then sometime during the stop, Beth and I continued to laugh. And Judith declared herself a very serious person. She said, "I'm serious." She said, "I've always been very serious." And somehow shortly after declaring that, she started to laugh. And she joined us because we put G on the end of everything. And we just couldn't stop laughing. You kind of had to have been there. And when she boarded, when we all boarded the plane, I was sitting in seat 13G. So Master just has an incredible sense of humor. So I had this pillow that I had been carrying around with me, and I kept leaving it places, and Judith would pick it up and say, "Laurie, your pillow." And she named my pillow Pillow G. And from that day, that's what it's been called. One last thing I want to say, which is a little bit harder. But I'm so grateful I had a few final moments between us. A few days before she died, I went up to sit in her room. And she was having a really lucid day. And she reminded me that my birthday was coming, which was yesterday, which kind of floored me. I mentioned that a seva that I shared with her for years was putting tablecloths on the table under the tent before the retreat. And it sounds like a small thing, but those tablecloths are really hard to secure on the tables. And we came up with all manner of strategies for securing those tablecloths. And I realized that she just had so much ingenuity because we used tape. She came up with this rope system for putting around the tables, and she labeled everything very carefully. But it just wasn't easy. And I told her this year that someone had come up with the notion of fitted tablecloths on the fold-out tables, which was like kind of rather miraculous. And she gave me two thumbs up. And moments before I left, I was holding her hand. And I was able to look into those beautiful eyes and tell her that I loved her. And she looked right at me. Her eyes were so radiant. And she told me she loved me too. I just thank her for her love and her friendship. And like the rest of you, I will miss her terribly. But know that she is in his loving embrace.
All right, I'm going to call on Susan Diamond to read a letter from Christine Corfage, who is unable to be here today.
Mira asked Christine Corfage to write, and Christine asked me to read. The rug under my feet once lay in the house of my ex-husband's first wife's mother. As that line from a poem I once wrote suggests, life can be complicated. And in the beginning, Judith's and my relationship was complicated. What woman isn't curious and even a little envious about an ex-husband's new wife, and she his ex? But along with that, there was also a natural bond between Judith and me. And over time, an understanding. Then, as our circumstances changed and we began living side by side on Osgood Road, in a weird kind of way, I felt complete, and our relationship became clearer and deeper until it wasn't complicated at all. Judith and I loved each other. I don't know why Judith loved me. I'm just grateful she did. But who wouldn't love Judith? What human being wouldn't be attracted to all that she was, to her physical beauty, to her attunement to nature, to her fierce aim to live a life of devotion, to her mystery. You had to be brave to get to know Judith. In fact, she made it clear that she preferred to stay hidden. But once you got to know her, you knew kindness. You knew strength. A woman who remade her life learning to make jewelry with a new husband in Tennessee. You knew generosity. A mother who bought her young daughter not one or two barrettes with colorful ribbons flowing from them, but a whole bag full. You knew big, scrawling handwriting and notes ending with passionately drawn hearts and rays of love. You knew a packed pantry, because if 1 gallon of maple syrup is good, a case is better. You knew a great cook who bought organic and loved lots of sugar in her tea. You knew a gardener who didn't discriminate among her prodigies. Flowers, weeds, they were all important. And just as Judith was reluctant to cut a flower, why hurt it? She mostly let the weeds grow. You knew a woman who adored her family and her friends, all of them, human, plant, and animal. A disciple who loved her master and this ashram. You knew a disciple who loved a satsangi who really did get up at 3 a.m. or earlier every morning to meditate. A devotee with a beautiful voice who loved to wrap herself in shawls and sing bhajans but didn't want anyone to hear her. You knew loyalty and lack of judgment. As steadfast as Judith was on the path, I've always been a skeptic. Judith knew this about me, and it didn't matter. She went on all the retreats. I went on very few. Once she rented an extra room at a hotel in another state in case I wanted to attend a retreat there. I didn't. It didn't matter. I was her friend. If anyone ever fit the description of an old soul, it was Judith. She seemed to have lived forever. Yet Judith often said she didn't feel comfortable in this world. Maybe that's why she made her home so full of comforts. A huge warming fireplace, rooms filled with rugs, ship's handmade furniture, potted plants, a soft couch, chairs piled high with shawls, pillows everywhere, spiritual books, photos of the masters, little notes, reminders, collections of rocks, paintings, crystals, small bowls filled with candy, bars of chocolate. Judith was a yogi who liked her stuff. And I loved coming into her house, looking around and taking it all in. Sometimes I'd try to copy her. Back home, I'd buy a backup jar of peanut butter, maybe an extra tube of toothpaste, fill the empty feeders, then scatter a few shawls around the living room, wrap myself in one of them, and sit down to meditate. But it didn't last. Before you knew it, the feeders would be empty again, the shawls put away. There was, and only ever will be, one Judith. 5 years apart, my October 11th birthday twin always seemed ahead of me. When I visited her before her diagnosis, but after Ship had first rushed her to the ER, she said, "Honey, you never want to know that kind of pain." I think one of the masters said, "It's good that we can't see into the future because we couldn't take it." He was right. Not knowing how long she'd live, for 10 months Judith suffered, and Ship, Mira, and Kate adhered to Judith's suffering and made her less alone. Now, since her last breath went out with the song of her beloved birds, in her death they comfort each other. I am writing this in San Francisco, knowing that soon after it is read, my friends will take the walk that I've taken a number of times, especially since Sarah Wiggins died and Bob Pearsall, now Judith, my dead friends, my living friends, I love you all.
Thank you. And we're going to close with a bhajan of Brahmanand sung by Judith. This is Brahmanand's bhajan, Anahada Ki Duna Piyardi Sado. This is on the back of your program. And I'll read the translation. O Sadhu, the sound of the limitless is loving. Sitting in the lotus position, close the window of the ears with your hands. Concentrate on the thin sound, which later becomes tinkling. In the beginning, they all sound together. Later on, they become distinct, as the bell, conch, flute, bina, and drums. When the sound grows by hearing it, day after day, the whole body starts trembling. The drop of nectar trickles in the mouth of yogis who are happy. They all forget the consciousness of the body, and there within is illuminated. Brahmanand says, in this way, the mind gets absorbed. This is my experience. O Sadhu, the sound of the limitless is loving.
Anahad ki dhuna pyari sadhu, Anahad ki dhuna pyari re, Anahad ki dhuna pyari sadhu, Anahad ki dhuna pyari re. Asana padamala ga kar kar se munda kane ki bari re. Asana padamala ga kar kar se munda kane ki bari re. Jinni dhun me sura tala kavo hota nada janakari re. Anahad ki dhun pyari sadhu, Anahad ki dhun pyari re. Anahad ki dhuna pyari sadhu, Anahad ki dhuna pyari re. Pele pele ral milavaje, piche niari niari re. Pele pele ral milavaje, piche niari niari re. Ganta shanka banasari bina, talamare danga nagari re. Anahad ki dhuna pyari sadhu, Anahad ki dhuna pyari re. Anahad ki dhuna pyari sadhu, Anahad ki dhuna pyari re. Dinna dinna sunata nada jaba bikase, kaya kamapata sari re. Dinna dinna sunata nada jaba bikase, Kaya kama pata salire Amrita punda jare mukamehi Jogi jana sukha karire Anadhi dhuna pyari sadhu Anahadki dhuna pyari re Anahadki dhuna pyari sadho Anahadki dhuna pyari re Taniki suda sabapula jata hai Gata me hoi ujari re Tane ki suda sabapula jata hai Gata me hoi ujari re Brahmananda lina mana hove Deki pata hamari re Anahadki dhuna pyari sadhu Anahadki dhuna pyari re Anahadki dhuna pyari sadhu Anahadki dhuna pyari re
All right, the family is now going to go out to the cemetery to place the ashes. You are all welcome to come along. If you have not been out there, it's a beautiful, beautiful place and beautiful, beautiful nature. And I'm sure that there are spiders there as well. Please let the family leave first. And after the cemetery, there will be a reception under the tent. All are welcome there. And if you wish to remain here in the silence of the hall, that's fine too, of course. So please, in that sense, don't cluster around the hall in conversation. Please be aware, some people may wish to remain in meditation. So we'll have the reception under the tent. God bless us all.